Jackie seems to want Elton to come on her tits at one point. Hello!
Hello.
And welcome to episode 22 of Season to Taste, a Doctor Who podcast. My name's Will.
And I'm Matt.
We didn't even arrange that, that's pretty good. And together we are ploughing...
Season to Taste. Yeah.
Together we are ploughing through what we technocratically call the 35 active years of Doctor Who.
Or her.
I don't know why I did that.
No. It was just a bit Lee and Herring for a moment.
In this episode we've cast our satirical eye on a series 2 of New Doctor Who, David Tennant's first series. And we selected the story Love and or Monsters. Matt, what did you think? Did you like it?
Yes.
It's interesting you say that. I think it's a bit odd, isn't it? It's a bit of a shocker, frankly. You know, I think we've moved on from the Slitheen after the first series, but you've got this childish, Slitheen-like monster actually designed by a child, played by a bloody comedian. You've got the Doctor and Rose chasing back and forth in one of the oldest cliché jokes in the world, and frankly quite embarrassing in Doctor Who, with comedy steaming buckets. You have dancing to ELO taking up about half the story. The Doctor and Rose are barely in it, and it's basically quite embarrassing, isn't it? And I can understand why it fares so lowly when fans talk about it.
So I was laughing because when you said steaming buckets, suddenly I had a picture of Jackie.
Again, I can't help you with your problems. I jest, of course. As I was watching it, I was trying to get in the mindset of the curious fan who doesn't like it and trying to work out what it is.
You don't really need about, to get about in the mindset, Love and Monsters, do you? Because Victor Kennedy is the fan that doesn't like it and he doesn't like to be touched physically or metaphorically.
And I think, obviously, people are allowed not to like Doctor Who stories, but there is that slight suspicion that the people who don't like it are the people being satirised.
Okay. I quite want to pick you up on that when you say Doctor Who stories, because for me, Love and Monsters is almost not a Doctor Who story, it's a story about Doctor Who, which is a slightly different proposition. It's something completely different than anything we've really seen before.
It is, but one of the things that's so good about the show is that it can just randomly do something different like that, and it always has. Mm. It's always experimented with different forms and styles, and I mean, even Greatest Show in the Galaxy satirises fans in its own way. But yes, this is a very different approach, necessitated by Billy and David having a week off.
Yeah, it's really unusual and curious. In some ways, though, it's kind of the centrepiece of Russell T Davies' entire revival of Doctor Who, I think. It's
a commentary on his own approach and style.
It is. It's absolutely that.
Right down to, you know, from the moment that Danny Blew off of Hustle says, oh, I put that bit at the beginning because it's more exciting. He's even discussing the structure of television drama.
Although, to be fair, that's more of a Moffat-ish touch than a Russell T Davies touch. Moffat's much more inclined to tell stories in a strange order.
Yes, although I think what you're therefore getting is Russell showing that he can do what Moffat's famous for, perhaps even better.
For me, Love and Monsters is probably the one story from the 21st century that I think's utterly essential. I just think it's an astonishing bit of work. I love it to pieces. I think it's brilliant. By far and away my favourite episode of that entire season, and this is from a man who thinks Army of Ghosts and Doomsday are practically the best thing ever. But I mean, Love and Monsters is just astonishing.
It is very good, and I think I described it when the time team did it. It's a love letter to fandom. And I think it really is. All the stuff about Linda is about fans, and in a really positive way. Victor Kennedy is the bad fan who comes in and, you know, just wants to make lists and just wants to do everything according to the rules.
And talks kind of in capital letters.
Yes, and and thumps his fists down. Whereas
probably smashes his TV as well.
But Linda are the happy fans, the nice fans, the people who make friends through Doctor Who, in the same way that they go every Tuesday to the space under the closed down library to get together and, in theory, to get together to talk about Doctor Who. It's like we used to come to London on the first Thursday of the month to go to the Fitzroy Tavern and met people there, theoretically, to talk about Doctor Who, and you gradually discover that actually it was almost expected not to talk about Doctor Who and to build friendships and other interests, and in the same way that in Love and Monsters, Mr. Skinner has his writing. You know, I even go to a writer's group now with people who I've met through Doctor Who fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think it's a really nice summation of that kind of fandom and the ability of the series to bring people together.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, so Love Monster's pretty good then. Moving on. Is there anything else you wanted to say about it?
It's really interesting the way that the Doctor's used in it. I like the fact that everything that Russell does with the Doctor, well, not everything, but some of the really important things that he does with the Doctor are really clear in the story. So, firstly, the Doctor doesn't, in himself, destroy Victor or defeat the monsters. He inspires other people. And all the way through the story, it's about how the Doctor inspires people in different ways. Mm. But at the end, he inspires the people that Victor's absorbed to rebel against him and kind of free themselves. So for the whole of the first season, I think there was an ongoing critique of the Ninth Doctor that he was slightly passive and relied on people like Charles Dickens or Rose to become...
Or Linda with a Y.
Or Linda with a Y, to become something more than they were before he met them and saved the day. But I think that's really important. The Doctor becomes a kind of catalyst. He becomes an inspiration rather than always having to do things himself. The other thing that I think is really important is the Doctor says, yeah, I might be sweet, yeah, I might be passionate, but I'm not nice. You know, that is very true of Russell's Doctor. He might be many things, but he is not nice. A lot of people who come into contact with him do die, including Elton's mother.
Mm.
He doesn't always win, and he's not just a kind of kind, floaty, space hippie. He's actually got a very hard, almost cruel side to him. And that comes through here, it comes through at the end of The End of the World, it comes through again at the end of The Family of Blood. It's a kind of recurring theme that Russell T Davies' Doctor is not just a nicey-nicey person. He's got a very harsh morality to him.
But he's not never cruel or cowardly.
Yeah. Perhaps never cowardly, and maybe he's not cruel, maybe that's the wrong word, but he certainly, he can be pitiless.
Mm. It's Sylvester at the end of Remembrance of the Daleks, isn't it? I mean, it's slightly different when it is the Daleks, but it's the, well, actually, I've set things up so that you destroy your own son, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to inspire you to do it.
No, I think that's really powerful. I think the fact that the Doctor is dangerous in Russell's stories is really interesting, and it kind of does, as you say, it crystallises something which is there in the old series, but it makes it really clear and makes it really scary in a way. The Doctor's almost more scary than the monsters sometimes.
Certainly, that it's a very dark moment. You're throwing in at the end of what is a very funny story, the death of Elton's mother. It's hard not to watch it and think of the League of Gentlemen Christmas special with Papa Lazaru Santa taking away Reverend Benice's mother.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just actually panning across and seeing her just lying there and then having all the Life on Mars style flashbacks.
I thought it was incredibly Life on Mars, yeah. No, I think that's true. What I particularly like about that as well is it's not the Doctor's battled the Absorber off before and was too late. He clearly won against the living shadow and defeated it. He was just a bit too late.
Yeah.
So he's won, but there's been a terrible price. But that the end of that as well, it's one of Russell's lovely, strange creatures. What was it? The living shadow from the Howling Halls or something like that. It reminded me of, you know, she's trapped inside every mirror and I threw her into a dwarf star or whatever.
Yes.
The Nightmare Child and all of these funny little things he invents. So I like that.
And if the story is almost in his absence about the Doctor, the character that it really develops on screen is Jackie.
Mm.
It's a brilliant story for Jackie, who, in all her previous appearances, she's feels three-dimensional, but she's there in a very, very supporting role. And actually, that will change a little bit at the end of the season, and she plays more of a role in the finale, with all the comedy stuff about her being a slightly older Rose travelling with the Doctor. But in this, she gets a really proper, both an examination of what it's like to be left behind, which again is about examining the Doctor's effect on people and relationships, but really funny as well. I mean, the scene in the laundrette with Elton is really, really funny, and then her incredibly, her wonderful summons back in the... I mean, that line that she says, you could always splash out on a taxi or whatever. I suddenly realised it's a much, much filthier line than I used to think it was.
It's filthy. But then you have that comedy, and Jackie's been generally used in the past as a kind of comic relief character, as the kind of slightly clueless version of Rose, who's always flapping about things and out for herself a little bit.
And someone else who can, certainly in Aliens of London, someone else who can be in peril.
Yeah, of course. And I know that changes a bit in The Parting of the Ways, where she helps Rose to go back to the future. But I think here she gets one of, in fact, probably is the best Jackie moment, where she confronts Elton. And it's so dramatic and so sad and so beautifully acted by both Mark Warren and Camille Kadjouri that it's absolutely stunning. I kind of watch that and my lip wobbles. I just think it's a really beautifully done moment.
Yes. No, I think it's very, very good.
Other things I like about that, the Il Divo joke is just brilliant. I don't know, I said to you, that the flat looks a lot grottier than it did in season one. The flat in season one, I just remember being very pink and kind of fluffy. And in that, the kitchen kind of looks a bit grotty and the living room looks a bit more downmarket than it maybe did in season one. I don't know whether I'm just misremembering and it's exactly the same. But
well, now Rose isn't working, she can't pay for a cleaner.
Well, that's true. But I just wondered, maybe it just looks a bit more real. Because this episode maybe is meant to just be a bit more real than some of the other episodes. It's not a kind of nicely dressed up council estate. You get a real view of what Jackie's day-to-day life might be like, and actually what her little flat might really be like when Rose isn't there and the doctor's not there to enliven it.
And yet, at the same time, you have amazingly unreal things. I mean, for both plot convenience and for company purposes, of like Elton standing there going, I'm going to have to scour the whole of London to find this mysterious girl. And then the old woman going, that's Rose. Bellenberg from Russ Abbott going, oh, it's Rose Tyler. She just lives over there. And it's one of those things where you go, if you're a Victor Kennedy fan who wants all Doctor Who to be like Resurrection of the Daleks or the Silurians, then you're sitting there going, you can't do that. That's completely undermined the plot, whereas, of course, it is just brilliant.
I like the fact that you raise that, because Victor Kennedy is pretty much one of those fans who, in the wilderness years, as they've now officially been entitled, he wasn't writing new stories about the Doctor or getting involved in groups that are only tangentially really about Doctor Who. But he's the one who wants to plug continuity points from years ago. He wants to know what the Doctor was doing when Elton was little. And he wants to know all about all of these gaps in the Doctor's adventures. Mm. He wants to know it all for himself. He's the one who would write something like a sequel to The Web Planet to explain an obscure continuity point.
Except he's not even that. He's the person who would demand someone else write a sequel
to
The Web Planet.
Absolutely. Yes. That's a much better comparison.
We've mentioned Elton a bit. I thought it was interesting at the beginning in particular that he's almost the opposite of Donna. Donna's kind of running gag is that she's managed to avoid every single of the strange extraterrestrial incidents on Earth that have happened in the past few years, whereas Elton seems to have stumbled across all of them.
Don't you think the Auton invasion looks better than it does in Rose?
Yes.
It's brilliant. I know it only lasts for a few seconds, but it's really scary.
There's about a quarter of a second you see the bride costume go behind the taxi.
I noticed that, but it's clearly there. And you just think, the director, whose name?
Dan Zeff.
Did he ever do anything else? Or was this the only one he's done?
He never did anything. Ever.
But why didn't they use him again? Because those scenes have a real scary energy to them, as the Auton mannequins kind of jerk to life and then you see them smash through the window. It's, ooh, really gets the fan gene going, doesn't it? And then, the nice...
Victor Kennedy's very excited to see the Autons again.
And then the nice replay of the kind of the trailer special effect, the kind of poster effect of
the pig spaceship,
smashing up Big Ben. Replay. They got their money's worth out of that shot, didn't they? It's very good.
It's lucky Victor Kennedy didn't turn up until later on, because actually if he'd been there when Bridget was showing her photos of police boxes, he'd have been very annoyed by the size of the windows and the proportions of some of those boxes.
Do you think that there's also another continuity touch that I picked up on? Do you think Ursula's basically Baruza in The Five Doctors? Kind of immortal, a face on some stone. And do you think then that Baruza and Rassilon maybe have a bit of a love life?
I do think that is actually, I mean, although I'm all for the humour in Love and Monsters, and I think it is really genuinely very funny, especially when it plays off the relationships in it, I do think the slab blowjob gag is one gag too many. It's amusing, but I just go, you know what, this is a family show, and when you actually have the line, we even have kind of a sex life. Or did he say love life, maybe?
Didn't he say love life?
He says love life. But even it's almost a bit too close to a child going, I mean, what does he mean by having a love life? Well,
kissing, dear.
Kissing the slab. It's also really weird, the slab moment. Aside from that, the nerdier complaint is that everything you watch, apart from when the Sycorax spaceship goes overhead and you're outside Elton's flat and he's peering up, but that's still a flashback. Everything where he's talking to camera is shot to camera.
Mm. In a fisheye lens, bizarrely.
In his odd lens. But then, almost out of necessity, I suppose, when he's then talking to Ursula, you're allowed these reverse shots onto the slab. And it right at the end of the story, having stuck to that storytelling device all the way through, it's a bit of a shame that it then almost crosses the fourth wall in the other direction, and suddenly you're in with him, but then cut back to the camera. It's a shame they couldn't just position the slab.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I didn't notice it until you just pointed it out, but you're right. At the start, when he doesn't have his zoom and he goes spooky into the camera, I was reminded of the DJ from Revelation of the Daleks a bit.
He
kind of speaking into the camera and doing...
The dialogue is really... He does things that you would never do in a script if you were not writing a real person. It seems an odd thing to say, you're always writing a real person, but he's given, like, very naturalistic dialogue. So he says, like, oh, boy, Quantum Leap style. And then he goes, oh, no. And he says, oh, no, again. And it's like he repeats the things he says in a very clumsy way.
Yeah.
That are the hallmark of someone making up a to-camera piece off the top of their head. And not a scripted drama. It's a nice touch of realism to the way he talks. I do like the ELO inclusion. I think it's a nice different thing. Again, you know, Russell Too does like its old bits of old music, like Britney Spears and Soft Cell and End of the World. And it uses ELO really well, both diegetically, is that the word? In having him actually dancing around to it and having Linda playing along, but also actually the way it uses Mr. Blue Sky, you know, one of the greatest songs ever recorded, to score through the whole piece and actually have the climax using the climactic parts of the song. Just it ties it all together really well and gives it a really coherent feel and gives him, in a very easy way, a bit more character. I wonder whether, given that ELO are three of the letters of Elton, I wonder if typing the name Elton made Russell think of ELO, or writing about ELO made him decide to call him Elton, or whether it's just complete coincidence.
I think maybe a lot of it goes back to the kind of late 60s, early 70s kind of vibe. Like, Elton's obviously a child in the 70s, and he's been a Doctor Who fan since he was 4 years old or whatever, or obsessed with the Doctor since that age. And
it's around the time ELO.
It's that kind of nostalgia, isn't it? It all fits into that period.
I do think poor Victor Kennedy probably should have... I mean, I don't know whether he's supposed to be from a race of Absorbaloffs. I assume he's supposed to have developed this technology to do the absorption himself. He's a one-off, which is why there's no name for him, and also why he needs the cane, a piece of technology, to stop himself falling apart. Because if that was a natural evolutionary development, they just wouldn't be able to survive, would they?
Yeah, I mean, it's not very clear, but then he was a Blue Peter competition monster. So I think...
I don't think that can be allowed to excuse it within the realm of Doctor Who as a viewer. Oh, well, it's all right that it doesn't make sense because he was drawn by a child.
No, it's an interesting point, though. I think you're right. I think he
must be a mad scientist who's turned himself into an Absorbaloff.
Yeah, not all clon people are Absorbaloffs, because he talks about it as a process, and the cane's obviously important to it.
Well, that's it. They could never survive as a race if you had to have a cane to
And he talks
you.
About... You know, going back to Clom in Triumph once he's absorbed the Doctor, which...
As if he's developed this as a weapon.
Power, back on his home planet. I did like the Raxicorica, Pretorius and Clom joke, so those were quite amusing.
Yes, it's a very funny episode. Other bits at the end, there's two things I like in that last scene. One is where he's reflecting on Rose and the fact that, you know, all these people who are kind of touched by the Doctor... died, which is a recurring theme as well in the series. But obviously it's only a few episodes before Rose is written out, and yeah. we have that, this is the story of how I died,
yeah.
line near an episode a bit later. But also I like his very, very final speech, which, you know, he is speechifying to camera. Mm. He's clearly Russell's mouthpiece at that point. Mm. But there's a wonderful speech about kind of life being more dangerous and interesting than just, you know, get married, have a kid, settle down, mm. do it all again routine. I think that's a very, it's a very creative attitude.
Mm.
But it's also really, it's a really lovely speech and a lovely moment and a lovely manifesto.
Mm.
One other thing that I just noticed in the credits, and I must have noticed before, but I've completely forgotten if I had, is that Sheila Wells was credited as doing the makeup. And apparently she did the makeup for all of Series 2. Mm. And she did the makeup, I recognise the name, because she did the makeup on Mordred and I'm Dead. Or that's not where I recognised it from. I recognised it from Blake 7.
Mm.
Because I saw her at Blake 7 or Blake 7 and Doctor Who convention in about 1996, doing a panel with Gareth Thomas, where she was talking about doing makeup and about the fact that she was in the past married to Gareth Thomas mm. from Blake 7. So there's a little makeup artist fact mm. from Love and Monsters. Well, I think it's fair to say we both enjoyed Love and Monsters.
Yeah.
And we do think it's very good, and we're very much in the Linda category and not in the Victor Kennedy category.
Correct.
Victor Kennedy, however, requires us to watch another episode of Doctor Who now and to choose it from our list. So we'll fire up the randomizer and find out what it is. Here we go. of course. With the impeccable timing that only the randomizer can muster, where do you think it sent us?
Forward or back?
Back.
Back to the beginning. No. Not 22.
No, much further back than that.
One.
Forward. With impeccable timing, I said. Which season, as of the last few weeks, would it be the most appropriate
for? Oh, season 5.
It is season 5.
Oh, okay.
Which is slightly inconvenient, because I watched some season 5 quite recently. So, season 5, Patrick Troughton's second season.
Mm-hmm.
We have Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yep.
The Abominable Snowmen,
yeah.
The Ice Warriors,
yeah.
The Enemy of the World,
mm-hmm.
The Web of Fear,
mm-hmm.
Fury from the Deep,
mm-hmm.
and The Wheel in Space.
Yeah.
Now, have you still not watched The Web of Fear?
No.
You haven't? Okay. Yeah, we certainly said, well, when we get round to season 5, that'll be a good opportunity to look at the rediscovered episodes.
Mm.
I have, however, watched the rediscovered episodes within the last few weeks. So, let's go through the motions and consider what we want to do. We can discount mm. Fury from the Deep, for it is not there.
Well, I think if we're going to go on that basis, then we can also discount The Wheel in Space, The Abominable Snowmen,
yep.
because those aren't there either.
Yep, definitely. So that leaves us with Tomb, The Animated Ice Warriors, The Rediscovered Enemy, and The All But One, plus Recon,
yeah.
Web of Fear. So we both watched Enemy of the World recently. I've watched Web of Fear, you haven't. I think we discount Tomb as being one that we've seen loads, or do you think... Well, I guess partly, do we want to watch and therefore talk about one of the rediscovered stories? Or is everybody talking about those stories at the moment? And so,
I would say up front, I'll be honest and say I find Season 5 probably the least inspiring of the 1960s seasons. A lot of the stories are very samey. I prefer Zoe, really, to Victoria, and...
I prefer Ace Under Siege.
The Tomb of the Cybermen is great to have a complete 60s Cyberman story. It's the only one.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that nice music, but it's not really that good, is it?
It has nice moments.
It's good in parts, yeah.
as Victor Kennedy would say, it's a curate. It was not a curate because it's not that bad.
No. I mean, it is good.
Yeah.
But it suffered. It's basically a pastiche of The Mummy, isn't it? Including, you know, the mysterious Asians who resurrect the mummy to mummies, i.e. Cybermen, to do their bidding. And the problem with almost every mummy film I've ever seen is that they're all a bit boring. Because basically the mummies come out of their tombs, stamp about a bit, and then die, and that's basically it. The Cybermen don't really have much of a plan in Tomb.
Mm.
They just kind of get woken up, stamp about a bit, and then it kind of finishes, because there's nothing really else to do, is there? And it's really atmospheric about their resurrection, but once they get up, I mean, the Cybermats wibble about for a bit and it all gets a bit tiresome. The Ice Warriors...
It is the human characters who are the interesting ones.
Exactly.
I don't think I've ever... I must have watched The Ice Warriors when it came out on video, but I have no recollection of it whatsoever.
Your mind's probably blanked. I would love to like The Ice Warriors.
It's just got snow.
But it's just boring. I mean, it's as tedious and boring as any Doctor Who story.
I don't find The Ice Warriors very interesting. I mean, I know a lot of people, and including you, probably like The Seeds of Death, but I find The Seeds of Death quite dull.
I prefer it to The Ice Warriors, because it's a bit more dynamic.
We do have the newly animated Ice Warriors, at least.
Yeah.
Although whether that means they're any more animated.
The Web of Fear, I think we should discount, because Episode 3 isn't complete, and it hasn't been animated yet, so...
I don't think we should discount it on that basis, because it's perfectly... I say perfectly watchable, it's quite dull trying to watch it, but...
I'm not that keen on Telesnap Reconstruction, so I don't really want The Web of Fear. I'm going to hold out, I think, to watch it until Episode 3 gets animated.
So is it being animated for the DVD release?
I have no idea.
All right.
But I'm sure...
You may be waiting a very long time, then.
Might be. I mean, I'm not in any rush to watch it.
Although we wouldn't do it for Seasons of Taste, you could do, in watching it generally, what I know other people have done, just skip it.
Yeah, I suppose. Which brings us to The Enemy of the World.
Yes, which we've both watched very recently. But, you can give it another go. I mean, I like, in a series where there are a number of quite samey Base Under Siege stories, I do like the fact, and have always liked the fact, that The Enemy of the World is a very different format and is a very different situation. You know, it's a globe-trotting political thriller rather than Monster of the Week.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to watch The Ice Warriors, except it probably wouldn't be.
I think it'd be a bit almost perverse not to watch the newly discovered complete story.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Okay. And it was always the one I liked the most from audios and novelisations, etc. from that series. Okay. We will refresh our not-too-distant memories of The Enemy of the World.
All right.
Come back next time and find out what a story that's been missing for 47 years is like.
In the meantime, come on, Will. Come and kiss the slab.
Bye.
Bye.
I mean, they walk away, and you hear a scream, and they don't hear a scream. I mean, this happens twice. It's ridiculous. Eczema? That's not even a thing. Linda's just from Why Don't You, isn't it? And the computer fizzing and exploding, that's just nonsense. That doesn't happen when forums get overexcited, and I know, because I've been on those forums. I think my real problem is it's about people with relationships and feelings, and dancing to ELO, it would never have happened in Inferno.